Some stations on shortwave sound like they've been around since the dinosaur era, presenting stories the way they did in the 160s, 70s, and 80,000 years ago. Snap out of your Mesozoic mood and switch to Radio Netherlands, contemporary continental radio from the heart of Northwest Europe.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks via PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another program from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
By shortwave and satellite, this is the Dutch International Service. Media Network, Radio Netherlands Weekly Communications Review with Jonathan Marks.
Atmospherics after dark, noise and voices from the past, across the dial from Moscow to Cologne. Interference in the night, 1,000 miles on either side, stations fading into the unknown.
Hello. This week we're on location and we'll be covering two media items in the next half hour. At the moment I'm seated in a large room of an English country mansion, but as you can hear, I'm not alone. People across the tables from me are wearing headphones, each person listening to a different radio station. 50 years ago this week, with war clouds looming in Europe, the British government requested the British Broadcasting Corporation to formally establish a monitoring service. In those days, broadcasts from Italy and Germany took priority. Half a century later, the operation is very different. The place is Caversham Park, a village just outside Reading, and that in turn is a 20-minute train ride west of London. Today we're guests of what's now called BBC Monitoring. Around 500 people work here, but half of them are directly involved with processing around 500,000 words a day from over 50 countries. The monitors work in the large mansion at Caversham, but most of the actual reception work takes place a few miles down the road in a 400-acre area called Crowsley Park. From the winding country lane, the trees obscure antennas that most shortwave listeners simply dream about. Keith Goff, manager of the operation services at BBC Monitoring, took me behind the building, where everything was clearly visible.
We've got quite a collection of aerials. We've got a selection of beverage aerials. Some of them are up to a kilometre long. We've got a selection of sloping Vs, some rhombics, and a couple of curtain arrays. They're still well-used aerials. They're bi-directional, of course. And we've got a collection of Band 2 up to Band 5 aerials.
So what's basically your job? Is it simply to pick up certain broadcasts and put them down a telephone line to Caversham?
Slightly more than a telephone line. We have a large cable between here and Caversham that we feed the voice programmes down. We can also feed radio telegraphy programmes down. That is one of our functions. Another function that we do is we carry out work for the EBU, where we measure the medium wave broadcasters that we can in Europe and North Africa, and occasionally even one that's coming across from the Americas. We were checking on the ionosphere for propagation conditions all the time. We're checking for SIDs, for highest received frequency. This all goes to help with the planning of broadcasts for our transmission planning people in London.
Because it's all very well having a computer model to work out what propagation should be like, but you do need a practical test.
Oh yes, we're part of the planning process in that we confirm that the planning has been done correctly in the past. It's also a good indicator of how, if we know how the ionosphere is behaving now, and that combined with the sunspot activity and what have you, then the planning people can go away and do their clever business with planning on how best to use our transmission times and frequencies.
Inside the building, one communications receiver is permanently connected to a pen recorder. This printer plots a graph of time against frequency.
We programmed it to scan 100 kilohertz of the spectrum, which we do every day. We check a different 100 kilohertz. This is also a function that we perform for the transmission planning people. The receiver then scans 100 kilohertz and it's scanning on CW and with a BFO set at 2 kilohertz. And what it's doing is it's taking the audio output, and as it comes up to a carrier, you're getting the tone built up and it's integrating the tone. And when it's integrated up to a certain extent, poff, it makes a plot out. After it's plotted a few times on that frequency, you're starting to get a line build-up, which shows that there's somebody occupying that frequency. And then our chaps are using the schedules, knowledge that they have and expertise, and identifying who's transmitting on what frequency. And we do that over a 24-hour period.
You talked about checking medium wave frequencies there, but just how accurately are you talking about?
We can measure quite quickly to a millihertz. We have a rubidium standard that can check to one part in 10 to the 11, which is quite accurate. And so we can check a medium wave transmission fairly quickly.
Now, obviously you've got HF antennas sitting there in the field behind us. Over there on the hill, I can see two satellite dishes.
Yeah, we have two 11-metre satellite dishes that we have recently installed for C-band.
But do you see a day when, they'll take down the HF aerials and just have satellite dishes?
Well, that's assuming that everybody goes over onto satellite transmissions. I think there are an awful lot of people that will still be out there listening on HF.
If you like listening to the high frequencies between 3 and 30 megahertz, and you've got all the space in the world, you might like to put up what's called a beverage antenna. At Crowsley Park, they've got 12 of them, mainly beamed at Europe, but also pointing to Latin America and Australasia.
For shortwave, our research department reckons that the ideal height and length for a shortwave beverage aerial is between 1 and 2 metres high and between 1 and 200 metres long. But we have a problem with having low aerials at Crowsley Park, is we have a lot of cattle there and the cattle would tend to walk through them.
In the main reception room at Crowsley, 38 Rakel communications receivers fill the walls. Each radio costs several thousand pounds. The engineer on duty has to tune up most of them according to a pre-arranged schedule. All the audio outputs are fed down a special cable, which emerges in the listening room at Caversham, several miles away. Stephen Lowe is the acting manager of the broadcast reception services. So why don't they simply have the radio on the desks in front of the monitor?
If you looked at the monitoring service 50 years ago, that would probably be the case. There were receivers operated mainly by the monitors. But these days, with the congestion on the shortwave bands, most of the signals are set up by specifically trained operators at Crowsley Park, which is some 4 or 5 miles away, and fed over landline to us here at Caversham. We also have various receiving sites elsewhere in the country and one or two overseas, which can feed signals direct into the listening room here.
OK, as well as monitoring the content of the broadcast, you've also got to know where to tune, because after all, if a crisis comes up, you've got to know what frequencies.
Yes, our section is involved in getting the schedules of just about every radio station that we can hear, and also a lot of those that we can't, in fact. And this is done by a variety of ways. In a lot of the Western European stations, they actually send us their schedules, and then it's a matter of merely putting them into our own particular format. But a lot of other stations don't send us their schedules, and we have to work out what frequency they're on at what time and the languages, and we do this simply by research listening. We have a chap, we sit him down in front of a receiver, we give him a blank schedule and say, fill it in.
So he's actually got to do band scans, is that it?
Yes, that is the way it's done. It tends to be done on an hour-to-hour basis, and the biggest task we have is the Radio Moscow external services schedule, and when that changes 4 or 6 times a year, we generally know the times of the broadcasts. They don't change too much from one period to the next, but of course all the frequencies do change, and we literally sit a man in front of a receiver. It's done 8-hour shifts. And if we know that Radio Moscow World Service is on the air, say at midnight to 0100 GMT, we use this man's expertise to find all the frequencies that Radio Moscow World Service is on at that particular time, and so on for every language that they use.
In front of me now is a draft copy of this week's World Broadcasting Information. It's about 10 pages of news about radio, TV and satellite developments. So let's have a look at the headlines. Well, there's a report from Turkey which says that the Bulgarian authorities have set up 250 jamming transmitters on their common border with the aim of jamming Turkish television. There are budget cuts at the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. A new 500-kilowatt transmitter in Gabon is testing between 19 and 21 hours UTC, carrying Radio France International programmes on 3305 kilohertz. Members of the board of the Southwest Africa Broadcasting Corporation in Windhoek have been meeting to discuss their future. Well, that's all published on Friday, and so it goes on. This information isn't cheap, though. 52 issues costs £350 sterling.
Private individuals do buy it, but it goes perhaps mainly to universities, other radio stations. Indeed, I know Radio Netherlands is a subscriber, and organisations like that.
And how many people producing that? Is it a big unit?
No, it's a very small unit. There's one person who works part-time in actually getting WBI together, but the section is a total of about 12 or 13 people, and WBI is only one part of their daily tasks.
Being a monitor sounds quite easy. At first, you just have to write down what you hear. Let's dip into the archives.
Now, I'll have you picture if you would. I'm a senior monitor, and sitting next to me is a woman trainee Russian monitor. Oh, good morning. How do you do? You're Mrs. Matthews, is that right? Oh, yes, here we are. Oh, well, I see it's coming up to 1900 now, so let's try and do the bulletin again, shall we? Now, what's the first thing we do before switching on the recorder? Well, besides fumbling in our handbag for a cigarette, put the paper in the typewriter. That's right. Then we type our name. Yes, both our names, Mrs. Matthews. 21 Kidmore Road, why do you ask? Don't type that! Our consumers are not interested in my or your address, just the names. USSR, home, Moscow, first program, time, and date. No, that was very good. No, that wasn't the pips, Mrs. Matthews. That was my pencil drumming on the desk. Okay, now, if you're all set, we'll get started. You missed the first item. Oh, well, never mind. I'm making a recording, too, so everything's all right, and we can fill in the number two as well. Oh, well, it takes a little time to get used to it. No, that was spring sewing in the Kuban, not an exhibition of sewing machines in the Kremlin. Yes, really, Mrs. M, I'm not making it up. You've got too many pets, and you've missed an Ofsk in Dnipropetrovsk. No, I don't know why they give them names like that. And that was a blast furnace being commissioned, not a poultry farm.
Back to reality. Just try writing down a comprehensive summary of any program you hear on the radio. It is tricky. Later this year, a brand new listening room will open at BBC Monitoring in Caversham Park, and typewriters that you can hear behind me that the monitors currently use will be replaced by computer terminals. Richard Measham is involved in that changeover process.
So what I'll do is I'll pretend to transcribe an item from Radio Netherlands Media Network programme. So first of all, I call up the special transcript facility. And when it appears, it prompts me for a special code, and I'll put in the code for Radio Netherlands and the time of the broadcast, and it's automatically given me today's date. Once I've confirmed the information I've put in, I'm then given a bulletin header where I can put in the headline of the item I wish to transcribe and various details relevant to it, like whether I'm going to text it or use excerpts or summarise it. It then presents me with a word processing package where I can then type in the relevant media network item. And once edited, it can then be moved on to the printing and publishing department. So what we've got is a complete electronic system from inputting the material through all the editing stages right through to publishing and distributing it electronically to databanks and to telexes and things like that.
The output from Caversham appears in two distinct forms. There's a newswire service which concentrates on current monitored events in short form, although without any comment or analysis. And then there are the four regional parts of what's called Summary of World Broadcasts. Chris Greenway is chief report writer for SWB Part 4, covering the Middle East, Africa and Latin America.
The largest team here at Caversham is the Russian team, which monitors broadcasts not only in Russian but also various other languages of the Soviet Union. And there are also other teams working in various other European and Middle Eastern languages. And the brief of the monitors for their own particular language area is to translate into English items of particular interest. Now, it varies from country to country what these might be. Obviously, in the Soviet Union, any statement or pronouncement by President Gorbachev or any other major Soviet leader, they would have to provide a textual translation of it. Other smaller items, say sort of a report on a factory opening somewhere in Siberia, is obviously not of such great importance. We would want to see the details of it, but they could provide a summary of it or a shorter report of it.
But if it turned out to be a very important factory, then obviously you could go back and make a full text of it.
Certainly. All the material that the monitors transcribes goes to the editors in the output departments around the building, and if they determine that they would like more details on this, then they can ask for the transcript to be expanded. All tapes of all material are kept for about a month here, and so we have a fallback so that even if, for example, we thought it wasn't very important, this factory, and we published it in the Summary of World Broadcasts, one of our readers might call back and say they'd like more details, and so with this month's delay with the tapes, we can still provide it to them.
You'll find it on the radio.
If you own a home computer, then maybe it can store up to a megabyte in its electronic memory. The new BBC monitoring system is about 8,800 times larger.
Yes, Jonathan, in fact, what we've got here is an extremely big system. We've got online storage of 8.8 gigabytes, which is massive by any standards. We have a supervisor in the listening room controlling the coverage and the flow of the coverage. And I suppose, in a way, our monitors are just like foreign correspondents, except we've got them sitting in front of either a television set or listening to a feed from a radio station.
Long distance calling in the middle of a radio net. So much static coming in your voice.
What we are monitoring here at Caversham is open broadcasts on radio and television which are designed to be received by members of the general public. Mostly we're interested in domestic radio and television because that is where the detail tends to come. We're interested in say, international broadcasts to a certain extent when they're putting over a particular political message and where perhaps they're involved in what one might call a radio war. For example, many parts of the Middle East, there are these radio wars that go on between different countries, and we're interested in monitoring international radio from that point of view. We also monitor news agencies. These are not generally available to the general public sort of direct, but of course you see them in your morning newspaper. Most countries in the world now, even the smallest ones, have some form of national news agency. And we find these very useful because often they will contain much more detail. For example, these days there is the concept of the sound bite, that is when a leader makes a speech, perhaps of an hour, on the evening news bulletin, you'll only get a few snippets of what is said, and this is becoming true not just in the West but throughout the world. The National News Agency will very often publish the full text of his speech, and we can obviously use that and we can draw a comparison. We can say, well, here is the full text as supplied by the news agency, and here is what the radio said. In other words, this is what the radio of the country thought was important in this chap's speech.
During the Second World War, monitors had to concentrate hard to hear the names of prisoners of war. Nowadays, receivers are better, but there's more congestion on the dial.
20 years ago, we were almost entirely reliant on shortwave and medium wave, and we were picking up just things as an ordinary DXamite. And I think at that time there was very considerable concern that the future of this place was threatened because the general expansion of broadcasting, the bands are becoming more crowded, there was jamming, of course, and there was a very considerable concern that because we were a lot of the time we're interested in domestic radio, that these stations were just becoming swamped underneath a babble of international broadcasting. Two things have helped to change that. Most significant, perhaps, is satellites. Now we're seeing a situation whereby quite small third world states are putting, say, their television service on satellite, and we've gone to a situation from where we perhaps couldn't even receive them at all on shortwave, their radio service, to where we can now get a perfect signal from satellite. The other change that has come about is that really in a continuing process ever since the monitoring service started, both ourselves, the BBC, and our cooperating American partners, the Foreign Broadcast Information Service, have set up a number of overseas listening bases around the world. For example, one of the ones that the BBC operates is in Nairobi in Kenya, which is responsible for monitoring broadcasts from East Africa and the Horn of Africa. This has two advantages. First of all, of course, from that part of the world, the signals when they are received here, if they're received at all, are weak and they can only be heard at certain times of the day. And the other point, of course, is that we're mainly interested in monitoring in the local languages very often, and it is often not possible to recruit in Britain, or it is very hard to recruit, people who can speak these African languages and who have the knowledge of the local area.
And you also refer to the FBIS. What do they do? Are they doing exactly the same sort of job but in other parts of the world?
Yes, essentially they are. The world has been split up over the years between the BBC and FBIS. The BBC is primarily responsible for Europe, both East and West, the Soviet Union, which is probably our most important target area, North Africa, and some parts of the Middle East, including Iran and Afghanistan, which are two very important countries. And from our East African unit, we monitor broadcasts from that part of the world. The bulk of the rest of the world is the responsibility of our American partners, the FBIS, though there is now and again a certain sort of interchange of coverage. Obviously, we can receive broadcasts from some of the other parts of the world here, but we tend to do it on a crisis-only basis.
Caversham Park is on a hill. You can see the country mansion from miles around. Although BBC monitoring started 50 years ago this week, in another part of England, the potential of Caversham was soon spotted. General Manager Barry Whitehall.
In 1941-42, it was decided that this site was probably of the right size. It had become available since it was originally housing a boys' school, which transferred a few miles up the road to another old country mansion. The BBC then took the site over. Technically, it was a good site, and this was one of the main reasons for moving here. The second reason it was taken by the government to give to the BBC to operate from here was the fact that we were fairly close to London. And at the moment, before the new computer system comes in, we are moving all our material in hard copy form, or the majority of it, and therefore at the moment it is delivered to London every day by a driver who leaves here first thing in the morning and delivers it around various government departments. Once our new computer system comes in later this year, that will become less of a necessity as everything will be fired off in data form.
How does it work at the moment? Is it the British government that's still financing BBC monitoring, and the BBC gets a bit of a spin-off in the sense that they can use the information?
Yes, BBC monitoring is part of World Service. World Service is divided into two, into the monitoring operation and into the broadcasting operation. Both operations are funded by the Foreign Office by two grants in aid, really. One that goes to broadcasting and one that comes to monitoring. The monitoring grant in aid is running at the moment at about £8.5 million. And from our marketing operation, we're making about £500,000 a year. Hopefully when our computer system comes in, we have plans to develop that slightly more and increase our income.
In the grounds of Caversham Park, a marquee's gone up this week for a 50th anniversary party tonight. And a special amateur radio station is on the air too, until August the 31st. In that regard, I believe we can now cue a phone call from Central Europe.
Hi, Jonathan. This is Wolfhard, Radio Austria International from Vienna. We're going to join the celebrations of BBC monitoring on Sunday the 27th from 15 hours GMT or UTC on 14270. You might have noticed this is right in the amateur radio band. There is a special event station from Caversham Park under the call sign of Golf Bravo 50 Mike Oscar November. And we shall have a sked with that station on Sunday the 27th at 15 hours on 14270. I will be on as Oscar Echo 1 Whiskey Hotel Charlie. And I hope we'll meet some of the Lysops among our listeners or some shortwave listeners who might like to drop in and get a QSL from the amateur radio bands and Golf Bravo 50 Mike Oscar November.
Thank you, Wolf. And also thanks to all the BBC monitoring crew for their tour of the facilities. As someone who benefits from their research, let me wish you all the best for the next half century. Now to other news, and back home in Hilversum, Holland, Radio Netherlands listener answer line has received more than 270 calls over the last 4 days, many of them very emotional. This past Saturday at 12.08 UTC, the pop music ship Radio Caroline left the airwaves. There are various versions as to what happened, so let's try to piece the story together. A week ago today, a series of coordinated raids took place at studios and private homes in the Netherlands and Belgium. Government authorities were looking for evidence that the offshore Radio Caroline was being tendered from the Benelux in contravention of marine broadcasting law. On Friday morning, a British customs ship drew alongside the Ross Revenge, anchored in the North Sea and home of Radio Caroline and two other services, Radio 819 and the shortwave religious operation World Mission Radio.
World Mission Radio, WMR.
Now, WMR used 6215 kHz, a marine distress frequency. Last Friday, the British customs ship asked Caroline to switch off 819 and especially 6215 kHz. Shortwave was silenced, but not the medium wave. Later that day, the British ship returned home. The following morning, a Dutch boat appeared alongside Radio Caroline. Bruno Voskuil, spokesman of the Dutch Ministry of Transport and Public Works in The Hague, told me the reasons why the Ross Revenge was then boarded.
The reason for the action was that there were several complaints by countries as England, Sweden and France about disturbance of radio traffic for the ships at sea. And moreover, a house search in the Netherlands had given evidence strong indications that within a short time one or two other ships would take position in the North Sea for similar transmission activities, broadcasting activities, because also Dutch people were involved in this Radio Caroline business.
And was this a joint action then, this past weekend?
It was a concerted action, joint action with the Dutch and the British, and the fact that the Dutch authorities intervened was that Dutch law offers more possibilities for intervention and for action in this case.
But Radio Caroline are accusing the Dutch and English authorities of piracy on the high seas, claiming that the Ross Revenge was in fact flying a Panamanian flag.
There was no flag on the ship, so it had been carefully checked that this ship was then not registered with any nation. It's not a matter of piracy. It had the action had been prepared carefully, also from the judicial point of view.
If you ring the UK number of 0836 404 302, you get a long official statement of Radio Caroline's side of the story.
In a statement, the Canadian directors of Radio Caroline said that they were shocked and horrified at this act of piracy. Having taken urgent legal advice, they would be bringing charges of piracy, assault and criminal damage against the authorities and against the individuals concerned.
Both sides claim they made video recordings of the event to prove their cases in court. The Dutch Ministry of Transport and Public Works strongly deny there was any violence.
There were six detective officers from the telecommunication service of the Netherlands and two police officers who went on board, and there was hardly any resistance. And there have been no damage has been done, as it is suggested by some people in England, the crew has not been arrested, but a lot of equipment has been confiscated.
And where is that now?
That has been brought to Holland, such as the transmission equipment and about 2 tons of gramophone records and the studio equipment.
We'll no doubt be hearing more about that story. In any event, this was the closing minutes last Saturday afternoon.
Right, as it stands, the gentlemen are going to remove the transmitter from the ship and take a few other things as well. We are free to go back to Holland with them, where there will be no more charges pressed. We will also be able to go back to England, and there will be no charges pressed there. Alternatively, we can stay on the Ross Revenge. Now, would you like to say anything, sir, before we go off?
That's it for now. I'll be back on Monday with a research file and next Wednesday for a special war documentary. Join us if you can. In the meantime, let me hand you back to Hilversum for the final goodbyes on this transmission. And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.